the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
When you're thinking about retirement, you're probably thinking about investments, Social Security, stocks, and bonds. But what about life insurance? What role does life insurance play in retirement? Well, just so happens the month of September is Life Insurance Month. And joining me on the program is Senior Advisor from Financial Sense Advisors, Aaron Wiegman. Aaron, why don't we begin with September is Life Insurance Month. What's the significance of that, and why do we even have a Life Insurance Month?
Well, Jim, thanks for having me on the show here today. You know, Life Insurance Awareness Month, it's a matter of raising awareness to the public about life insurance and how it should be incorporated into a financial plan. So the question that always comes up with clients is, you know, what happens if your spouse doesn't come home tomorrow? Is the family going to be okay? Now, emotionally, that is, of course, going to be tough for the family. But when people ask that question, it's really more about thinking about the finances and, financially speaking, is that family going to be okay? So when LIMRA did a study back, they do this every year, actually. LIMRA is the Life Insurance Marketing and Research Association for the industry. And when they did this study, they said that 84% of people think that getting life insurance in general is a good idea. And of those people, 66% of those say that, yes, I do in fact actually need life insurance. But only 57% of people actually own it. And most of those people who wind up owning life insurance, the only life insurance that they own is just simply from their group life insurance at work. And so when you look at those numbers, the majority of people in the United States are actually underinsured or uninsured altogether. 4 in 10 households in the United States would actually be unable to pay their bills if the main breadwinner would die.
And, you know, Aaron, when you think about life insurance, I wonder how much of this has to do with, you know, it's not a topic that you're sitting around the table talking about all the time. We don't like to think that eventually we die. And it's a necessary kind of backstop to replace income. And I want to get into this when it comes to people that are retired later on. What about, let's say, the reasons for life insurance ownership will probably change? I just got married. We started a family. We got a couple kids. We bought a home. We have a mortgage on the home. And obviously, I haven't had enough time working to save enough money to take care of the kids, the family. So let's sort of talk about how those needs change over time. What I might need starting out a family in my 20s or 30s may be different in terms of what I may need in my 50s or 60s.
Yeah, you know, if you think about how needs change over time, I mean, just like you said, if you're that young family, primarily what you're going to be wanting to do is, you know, protect the income that you're bringing into the family in general. So, I mean, there's things just protecting the income. Maybe you have a big mortgage that you're paying for. You've got a bunch of kids that, you know, it potentially could be going to school. So there's a lot of just high need for the insurance and just the coverage in general. So a lot of people wind up covering that with some, you know, cheap term insurance to just put the coverage in place and just be able to get what they need. Then you wind up getting into your 40s, your middle income years. You know, you're making a little bit higher income. Maybe those needs have changed. Maybe you're saving a little bit more money. You have a small business and some of those needs for life insurance wind up being business related. You're thinking more about accumulation of assets as opposed to, you know, when you were younger, it was more about just protecting the family. And then you kind of move on into retirement, where a lot of people tend to think that, you know, once I wind up hitting retirement, I don't necessarily need life insurance anymore. Well, I think people are kind of realizing that might be a misconception out there in the general public, because a lot of people, even when they come into retirement, they're still going to have some debt that they need to manage. You know, a lot of people go into retirement still with a mortgage that they probably need some protection for. And if they lose one or another spouse, there's a loss of maybe Social Security or pensions that they're used to and help pay for that mortgage. And just on top of that, a lot of those people, when they get into retirement, they're thinking about more things like long-term care. How do I pay for that? And these days, there's different combinations of long-term care and life insurance that wind up helping do a combination of those needs. Much less, when you're thinking about retirement, and if we are good at the job that we wind up doing with our clients, there should be some assets left over if we haven't used all of them. And so, you know, at that point, we wind up thinking about how could we use maybe life insurance for legacy needs? Could we leave a legacy to our kids? Do we use it for charities? Is it tax planning? So there's a lot of different reasons why you wind up needing life insurance or strategies around life insurance throughout your lifetime.
Aaron, I want to kind of stay on that topic right there, and especially for our listeners who are maybe heading into retirement or retired. And I want to talk about two specific instances. So husband and wife retire, and let's in this case say the husband was the breadwinner. He's making, he's getting $28,000 in Social Security. The wife gets half of that, $14,000. Husband dies. So wife has the choice to take her husband's Social Security at $28,000, but she just lost $14,000 of her Social Security. And for some people, losing $14,000, that's like almost equivalent of having, you would need almost $600,000 or $700,000 of assets to replace that income. So let's talk about that. And here's another thing too. I call it the widow's penalty. So the surviving spouse loses her Social Security and she's put into a higher tax bracket on a lower level of income. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, you know, just what you're saying, I mean, we come into that quite a bit. You know, there was a client that we were working with not too long ago that had that same kind of situation. You know, the one spouse had a pension that we were working with, and the other spouse had a good majority of Social Security. So their floor of income was really based on those two very things. And so it made a whole lot of sense for us to, you know, as they are approaching retirement, it was that conversation that we had with them about, do we give up these, they had term policies in place, you know, and so it was a matter of, do we give up these term policies or do we do something to convert or get new policies to be able to make sure that we can account for that income that would be lost if one or the other spouse dies. So we do that kind of planning on a regular basis just to make sure that that could be a big loss. When you look at that floor of income for people, if that is, you're still going to have the mortgage, you're going to still have the basic expenses of living your lifestyle. And so losing one spouse, you're not going to be necessarily decreasing those expenses considerably. And if you're dependent on that kind of income, we have to make sure if there is excess, you know, funds to be used to see what we can't do to make sure that we can account for the what ifs in life. And if when it comes to financial planning, a lot of our planning kind of stems around what happens if you die too early or you live too long.
Speaking of living too long, let's move on to another scenario that a lot of retirees will end up dealing with because longevity keeps increasing. So you can spend maybe 25 years in retirement. That probably wasn't the case 25, 30 years ago when life expectancy was less. So let's talk about a situation where one spouse, or sometimes it could even be two, end up in a long-term care facility where, you know, that was something you weren't planning on. How can life insurance work into that? Because a lot of people, if you can do it and afford it and you take it out early, you get a long-term care policy. But those can get quite expensive. Let's talk about the life insurance alternative.
The alternative to doing that and using life insurance, you know, today they wind up creating a little bit more of a hybrid type policy that incorporates some long-term care benefits along with a life insurance policy. And a lot of people, it's gaining momentum, I would say, in the industry itself. LIMRA, you know, the same marketing organization, they've done some studies with people too. And the majority, I think 53% of people are interested in something like that because they're attracted to the value and the flexibility of those policies. You know, because let's just say I do need the long-term care. These type of policies, you can access those benefits if you need the care either in the home or in a facility. If you don't ever actually need that care, it winds up passing on to your beneficiaries income tax-free as a death benefit. Or if you actually need the premium back, that's something where down the road you could get a portion or all of your premium back to you if you say you want to just surrender the policy at some point in time in the future too. So it's they like that kind of a flexibility as opposed to in the days gone by where the standalone long-term care policies, it was use it or lose it. If the experience for that specific insurance company, if their experience for that long-term care policy went up, they wind up putting out some sort of a premium increase on the clients and they don't necessarily like that. So these types of things, it puts a little bit more definition to the planning that we can do with people and gives them the flexibility as well.
And what about, you know, one of the issues that you talk about a lot of what ifs, and that's the problem that we all deal with when you're working on even the best laid plans. You don't know how long you're going to live. You don't know which spouse passes away first, or if you're single, you don't know how long you'll live or what your health condition will be at age 80, 85, or 90, or even 90 plus. So isn't this one way to give yourself a little bit of flexibility when the unknowns are really unknown?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, it does give you the flexibility. People like it because of the flexibility of that. You know, it kind of covers all three bases of what could happen in your future. Do you need the money back? Well, we can get the money back. If, you know, you never actually use it for long-term care, great. I hope nobody ever actually uses it for long-term care. And it just winds up passing on as a death benefit.
I want to talk about another issue related to that. And let's just make this easy. Let's just assume husband has $20,000 a year in Social Security. Wife is getting half, $10,000. Husband dies, so the wife is going to lose $10,000. And they need both Social Security checks to live on and live comfortably. The wife or surviving spouse wants to be able to live and maintain their lifestyle. How do you determine the right amount of insurance? Like one easy kind of back of the envelope way to calculate it is divide 3%, which is probably the long-term bond rate on corporate bonds that you could get to replace that. But how do you determine how much is needed to take care of those needs?
That differs for everybody. You know, for in that type of situation, you know, maybe you just wind up looking at, are there certain things that we would want to clear? Are there certain debts that we would need to take care of that would, you know, I guess, reduce the income need? In anyone's situation, whether it be that retiree or if it's that young family, there's a couple of different ways that you can kind of determine the amount of life insurance that someone should or, you know, could need. On one hand, you wind up looking at more of a needs analysis of that. And, you know, I guess there's three levels of that in general. First and foremost, let's take a look at what kind of debts it is that you would want to clear out. So if I wind up passing away, I want to make sure that whatever it is that I owe to somebody, we're going to clear that out. So if that's the mortgage, if it's, you know, different kind of credit cards or what have you, let's make sure that those are paid off. But even if I do wind up paying off those debts, would my family still need some sort of income? So let's figure out how much income the family would actually need on top of that. And then let's add that number on top of that. And then last but not least, if we wanted to go to the third level, then we wind up looking at it and we say, well, is there any sort of legacy that I want to leave? Or is there education for the kids? So you can kind of add in those different elements and see what that number adds up to. The other way that you wind up looking at it is, you know, let's just say there's an economic value to insuring something, right? So Jim, let me ask you a question. If you're insuring your house and you wind up having a house that's 4 bedrooms, 3 baths, 2 stories, you know, 2,500 square feet. Do you get the right amount of insurance to replace that if it burns down, or do you only get enough to get a 2-bedroom, 1-bath?
I'd want to replace what I lost.
Yeah, so that's kind of the idea. And so if you wind up taking the emotional element out of the life insurance factoring in there, you know, you look at someone with how much money it is that they're making for the family and the economic value to that person and the family. You know, if you look at the high end of things and the way that a life insurance company actually looks at it, they look at you as though you're that money-making machine for the family. And for most people, your ability to make money for the family is going to be your biggest asset. So let's just say you're a 40-something-year-old that is making $100,000 a year. Well, if you're going to multiply that out until retirement time, you could be making, you know, just simple math, $2 million for the rest of your lifetime. And that's the, you know, on the high side, that might be how much money a life insurance company could insure you for. So somewhere between those two numbers, that's a lot of times where we wind up playing with, you know, how much do you want to insure? And kind of it's a personal preference for the family and for that client who is purchasing that insurance.
So up until this point, Aaron, we've been talking about replacing something that you lose. A spouse dies, replacing Social Security, replacing loss of income. I want to talk and take a different tack, and let's talk about tax-free income as a tax planning tool and something called the LRRP, which is you see these probably, I would say, probably 85% of your top-end Fortune 500 company execs probably have them as a benefit provided by the company. Let's talk about what is it, how it can be used to provide tax-free income when you retire and sort of fit in with things like a Roth IRA or a pension. Let's talk about what it is and how it can produce tax-free income.
Sure. I guess to kind of back up before we even talk about that too, as you walk through with a client where potential retirement income could come from, and you think about the three main ways of saving and how it winds up getting taxed. So you wind up having your taxable bucket. So, you know, things that you think of in that taxable bucket, it would be, you know, anything that's in a taxable mutual fund, bond, stock, money market, CD, you know, anything that's going to get any sort of interest, dividends, capital gains, anything that you're going to get a 1099 at the end of the year. And in that 1099, you're going to have to add that to your taxes. Now, for you, you know, you wind up thinking about how much is that going to grow to over time? And do I want to continue to contribute to my taxable income as that bucket grows, right? So I have that bucket there. Then I have this tax deferred bucket. That in that tax deferred bucket, that's the stuff where you look at, you know, I'm going to put that money into that bucket and I'm going to defer my taxes today, pretend I didn't make it today. And at some point in time in the future, I'm going to take that money back out and it's going to be completely taxable to me. Now, at what tax rate is that going to be taxable to me? That I'm not really sure. You know, so those in that bucket, the typical stuff that you wind up looking at in there, it's going to be your 401ks, your SEP IRAs, your IRAs, your 403bs, your 457s, you know, you name it, where we're deferring income and then taking that out at another time. And so I know, you know, as you wind up looking at the tax rates and where potentially they could go in the future, if you think that you're in a pretty low tax bracket right now, is that the best option for you? And one way I like to pose that question is that, Jim, if I were to give you a loan, what would you want to know about the loan?
Well, certainly the maturity, the interest rate, and payment schedule.
Well, I tell you what, how about based on my financial situation when I need the money back, I'll let you know what the terms of that loan are. Would you take it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? You know, so if I said that, you know what, I ran up a little bit more debt than I was thinking of, you know, it's 10 years later. I think we're going to have to ratchet that interest rate up to 20% instead of the current 4% right now.
Don't think so.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Well, that's kind of what we're doing with that tax deferred bucket. And so when we think about using the tax deferred bucket, and that's primarily where a lot of clients have assets today. Now, going forward, if we think that in general taxes are going to be going up in the future, what's our other option? So we look at this tax-free bucket that you talk about. And if we're going to use that tax-free bucket, what are our options inside of that bucket?
Aaron, can you do like we've seen with variable annuities, variable life insurance policies? Let's say, I don't know, I'm planning retirement. I'm 10 years away from it. I do want tax-free income and I want a couple tax-free buckets. Maybe I'll do a Roth, but I want to be invested in stocks because the market's been going up. I want to earn a higher return than what I could earn in cash. What are those possibilities?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at that tax-free bucket, you know, some of those options within the tax-free bucket are really, you know, here's the Roth, here's, you know, maybe it's a 529 plan. You know, there's limitations with those, you know, and what we can do with inside of that plan. So if we do have extra monies to allocate towards something, where do we put it where it's going to have that tax-free savings? And so a lot of people, when they wind up looking at a life insurance for that option, you know, it's a little bit different. Typically speaking, in a lot of the protection-based life insurance that people are used to, typically what people wind up doing is they buy the largest amount of insurance they can for the smallest amount of premium possible. Well, in this kind of situation, what we try to do is if we really want the cash accumulation inside of a policy, we try to flip it on its head completely. And we say, how much money can we fit into the smallest policy possible? Because the IRS actually gives us limits as to how much money we can put into there because of the tax-free nature of life insurance itself. And so the options as that cash grows inside of a policy, you can do it fixed where, you know, there's just a fixed interest rate. You can do it variable where it goes up and down with the market as we allocate into different funds. Or what a lot of people actually like these days is some sort of a hybrid between those two. And it's an index universal life where there might be a floor where you're not going to lose any money if the market takes a dive, but you're also going to be capped on the upside as to your overall return. But people kind of like that in between of, you know, this might be my semi-safe type money that I can grow in here and have access to that tax-free down the road.
All right. Well, let's talk about another way that life insurance can be used. Let's say I own my own business So, or I may own my business with a partner. So let's say we're in a partnership. So let's talk about things like buy-sell agreements, key person insurance, executive bonus. Say I'm critical to the business. Something happens to me, it's going to affect the business. So let's talk about some of those uses.
Those are three kind of separate strategies that we will carve out for a business that we're working with. And so if you have a business with two owners, you know, a lot of times you talk to clients about, you know, do you have a buy-sell agreement in place? And a lot of times they might know what that is, but has that buy-sell agreement actually been funded? And what I mean by funded is that let's look at the reality of it. If something happens to one of those two partners, do we have the funds to buy out the shares of the other partner and make them whole? A lot of times that's not the case. And the most cost-effective way of funding that buy-sell agreement is by having a life insurance policy in place to make sure that the business or the other owner does have the means to purchase the other shares from the partner. So that's the buy-sell agreement itself.
Now, what about key person insurance? Let's say I've built a business and there's some critical people. Let's say I have a manufacturing plant and my head engineer is really critical in terms of making the product or making things function. So I have several key employees in the business.
Sure. I mean, think about if something happened to that key employee, how would that affect the business financially speaking? So even if it was one of the owners or an employee or something like that, your head salesperson, how would the business financially be hurt by that person not being there anymore if they didn't show up to work that day? So a lot of times with key person policies, the business might own that on that key person. And so if something happens to that key person, the business now has money to be able to get through those hard times in the business, as opposed to just be hemorrhaging the cash to try and like, A, how do we wind up getting through that time? If it's someone who's detrimental to our organization, that could be huge on us financially. So it's just a sum of cash to help you through that time. Maybe it gives you the opportunity to find the right person to replace. And maybe it gives you enough time to actually make some mistakes on finding a replacement person. It gives you that flexibility to work through those tough times in the business.
And then I guess that maybe the final one, and we see this, especially at Fortune 500 companies, we talked about the LERP, some kind of executive bonus that's favorable for the company and the employee or the executive.
Yeah, it's that same LERP idea, but it's just from the business side of things. So, you know, it's a way that businesses tend to carve out special benefits for, you know, whether it be a key, highly compensated employee or a key person within the business that, you know, say they do have, it is that key person that they want to have stick around. You know, it's nice that the business has the key person policy on them, but maybe to sweeten the deal a little bit and make sure that they stick around, maybe they put some sort of an executive bonus in place where they can have one of those LERPs for the key employee. And that gives them extra money in the future that could be tax-free income for them come retirement time.
So we've talked about various uses of life insurance. We talked about, for example, income replacement. That could be a young family starting out that has mortgages, has kids to raise. We talked about also income replacement, for example, in retirement where one spouse passes away and the survivor loses his or her Social Security. We also talked about using it for what we call the unknowns, whether it's loss of income of Social Security or taking care of long-term care. And we talked about business and tax-free accumulation. Aaron, as we close, if our listeners would like to contact you regarding financial planning services or even in the area of insurance, how could they do so?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they can do one of two things. You can email me at aaron.wiegman, that's aaron.wiegman, at financialsense.com, or you can always give me a phone call at 888-486-3939.
All right, Aaron, thanks for joining us on the program and apprising us of all the uses of insurance. Still a valuable tool when it comes to planning. All the best and come back again.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jim.
That concludes my interview with Aaron Wiegman. Once again, we're seeing so many uses of insurance today, whether you're trying to accumulate tax-free income for retirement, as we talked about on yesterday's program, or you know, you're thinking about this situation. I call it Plan B. And that is, what happens If something happens to one of you, how will that affect your income, your cost structure? How are you going to replace that income? Or even down the road, as Aaron talked about, some of the unknowns. You know, what if you live to be in your 90s? What if both of you or one of you ends up in a long-term care facility? So there's still a need for it. We've gotten this assumption, well, you know, I'm grown now. The kids are grown up. We put them through school. They're married. I don't need it anymore. We're finding more and more there's still a need for it. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.